Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Down the house on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, here for another fix of talking about design, architecture, and their creative arts. Today, we're going to have a conversation about criticism. Yet again, you know that that is a subject dear to my heart, as I have criticized critics, most recently in episode 67 last June, in which I laid out my rules for criticism. Now we're going to hear about architectural criticism from a real architectural critic, Alexandra Lang. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I'm happy that on just very short notice you were game. Just about a week ago, a piece appeared in the Times Opinionator by Allison Arieff critiquing Alexandra's new book on... Well, it's titled Writing About Architecture, Mastering the Language of Buildings and Cities, and I haven't gotten all the way through it, but I have to say that for those of you, my friends, the young architects, this should be on your bookshelf along with the Moore and his partners there. Anyway, The Place of Houses, this is a really good workbook. It's got really fabulous stuff that you, Alexandra, have excerpted from other good architectural critics, placing the appraisal of buildings in their urban context, which is dear to my heart. Now, not all architects feel that either we should make things better or that we should even be in any way responsible for doing so, or responsive to context. My old teacher, Peter Eisenman, and I had him early in his career, inculcated or attempted to inculcate upon us the notion that architecture is architecture and leave it at that. Pay no attention to those people that it should be culturally responsive or even urbanistically responsive. And so this opinionator piece provoked a minor shitstorm in the internets. We can say that because this is internet radio. With all sorts of young blowhards saying, ah, populist, anti-intellectual, blah, 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 blah. So in no particular, well, actually in some particular order, I'd like to talk with you about what you think makes for good criticism, what makes for bad criticism. If we have the time, I'd like to talk about this archibabble, this alien language, this sort of Martian speak that appears in journalistic circles of so-called academics. And I have some really good examples that we could talk about.
Okay.
But to start out with, just for a couple minutes before our first musical break, why write about architecture and for whom, Alexandra, do you write?
Well, I write about architecture because I really can't see myself doing anything else. It's something that I've had a passion for. I mean, architecture, I've been passionate about since I was about 13 or 14. And I learned when I was in college from a lot of people who were great writers about architecture, including Vincent Scully. And then after college, I came to New York and I started working for New York Magazine. And I felt like I started to see a way that I could talk about architecture and write for a wide audience, or that's what I've been trying to do all along. It's something that a lot of people don't understand. I'm always talking to people that say, oh, well, that's so interesting that you do that, but I never read anything about that. But I try in all of my work and part of what this book is about to show people that they should care about it and that if it's written about properly, it connects to so many other things that are part of their lives and environments.
I couldn't agree with you more. But you mentioned Vin Scully. Vin talks to a pretty high level because he's teaching architecture students, or used to.
Well, I mean, I took his class as an undergrad, and it was a huge, huge lecture. So it was by no means all architecture students. And I have to say, what I actually took away from it was his use of visual language and the sort of visceral language and the power that he spoke about architecture with. I mean, it was clear that, you know, certain buildings, and there's kind of a notorious spiel he has about Frank Furness, the Romanesque Revival architect who did a lot of work in Philadelphia,
yeah,
where he talks about the forms of the building crushing in on each other and all of this. And, you know, I still remember that 20 years later, and I feel like that is something that you can see and that should connect with people who aren't architects.
And that, you know, that I'm so glad that you said all of that, because it leads right into the first topical musical break, which I think is a great illustration of how to be lyrical and descriptive, which I think all good criticism should start with at least an exposition and some sort of explication of what it is that you're looking at. Could we have 3 minutes of T-Rex, please?
By White Oak Pastures. The Harris family has lived and farmed White Oak Pastures for 145 years. They are committed to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. Their mission? We take care of the land and the herd, and they take care of us. For more information about their cattle and their farm, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Now, I got to say, that inspired us at Cooper Union in the 1970s to think about our outrageous explanations for what we are trying to design. It's all about rock and roll for some of us. So back to Vin Scully, describing Frank Furness stuff as being crushed. And, I've learned some of those lessons myself. Although I did not go to Yale, I heard a few of Scully's lectures, and they stuck with me. And you add on to that. Now, from the point of view of being an architecture critic, and being, as I understand, married to an architect, so you must just eat, breathe, live. and also your house was a dwell project, and we could possibly talk about that later on. We don't want to pump up dwell too much. Perhaps in the future there'll be a sponsor. Anyway, what makes for good architectural or design criticism?
Well, I mean, I guess the bottom line for me is always clarity. I really try to teach my students how to be clear. And it sounds very simple, but it's very difficult, to get from what you're thinking and feeling and seeing in your head and to get that on the page in a way that other people can understand.
Oh, absolutely. And that is not taught in architecture school.
Well, yes. Well, I mean, among other things, I'm hoping that my book might be assigned in architecture schools.
Understood.
Because I think that not enough reading and writing are taught in most architecture schools. Or they're taught, but they're clearly not a priority. And, the studio classes are a priority. So they get kind of shunted to the back of the list, and people, don't necessarily do the assignments. But to write clearly really helps you to think clearly, and then obviously to talk clearly about your projects. And that's something that's such an important part of being an architect in practice.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd like to, just as an aside, I had an interesting conversation with Bjarke Ingels, who I hope in the fullness of time will find a space in his very busy calendar to come and talk on the air. But what I put to him was that what I took away from his presentation style, which is intoxicating and hypnotic, is that he is able to make very complicated propositions simple. And you see that in the visual work that the BIG practice does when they have their competition entries. They take very, I hate to use these words because I'm falling into the trap that I would wish to criticize nuanced or ephemeral or perhaps sophisticated or delicate, all these words that really don't mean anything, situations, and create an architectural expression that responds to sight and to program. I think that is really important, especially now more than ever. There should be clarity of expression because it indicates to me clarity of thought and completeness of thought. I'd like to refer to an article, that appeared in, I found it in printmag.com, The Anatomy, An Anatomy of Uncriticism. In which you're talking about Apple products, in which someone wrote, "No one can complain and has a right to." And you say that as a critic that's stuck in your craw. And I'd like to extrapolate that to the world of architectural criticism, where it seems as if there was an unspoken agreement to not say anything negative about projects, even if it's merited.
I'm not sure I agree with that, though I have to say it's interesting that you brought up Bjarke Ingels, because I wrote something else last year about his work, because I went to see his 8 house in Copenhagen, which had been receiving a lot of press, mostly via spectacular photography, and I felt like he, above many other candidates, is getting kind of a free pass from critics because he is so charming, because the work looks so stunning, perhaps because we're hoping he's solved these problems that, people have been struggling with, how to make, a house that's, sensual and urbane and relates to the street and all of these other things. but I felt like being at 8 house, it felt plunked down in the middle of semi-nowhere, and it wasn't very urbanistic, and I didn't understand why more people weren't asking questions about what it was really like to live in his work. So I guess I half agree with you and I half don't. I mean, I do think there are people out there being critical, but I think it can be easily drowned out by the amount of just kind of positive, based on photographs and rendering, design blogging.
Well, all right. For those of us who are not intimately aware of the Bjarke Ingels Group's portfolio,
sure.
Tell us about 8 House.
Okay, 8 House is part of this new neighborhood that's under development on the outskirts of Copenhagen. It's all on a train line. And what it is to date is basically a series of large, extremely stylish housing and retail projects. And the 8 House is shaped, you know, in plan like a huge 8. And in section, it's sort of like a huge ski slope or roller coaster. So it's, you know, two sets of housing around two courtyards. And to get into it, you kind of, you know, cut under the cross piece of the 8. And what that gets you, what that plan gets you is, you know, all the apartments have, you know, huge exposures and, you know, lots of glass. And there's even kind of a staircase up the outside of the building so you can get to your apartment without taking an elevator. Some of the roofs are stepped and they're green roofs. And it looks out over this sort of savanna-like area. And the nearest neighbor is the airport. But on the other hand, you know, to get to your apartment from the train station, you're basically walking through a huge parking lot. And I couldn't see any stores nearby. So it's like, okay, you live in this fabulous place, and it's accessible by public transportation. But once you're there, you're sort of on this style island.
Yeah, and also then the other Magic Mountain project
is in New York. Yeah.
No, well then there's one in Copenhagen with all those very acute angled balconies jutting one over the next. And I would say that from what you've described about 8 House and I guess it's M House, is it? The mountain house is both provide a lot of parking, which is the last thing that I understand that the Danes actually want, because if anybody's got a chance at an anti-automobile urbanism, they've got a chance at it.
Yeah, no, that's true. And actually, we visited some of the other buildings that are all occupied and construction has been completed, you know, along the train line. And the entire first floor of all those projects was lined with bike parking and little lockers, which was really amazing to see.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That we would be well to emulate in
New
York.
And it's interesting. I mean, the project that Bjarke Ingels is designing for New York on, I think it's West 57th Street, it just won an AIA New York award this week, also is basically like half of the 8. it's a single courtyard building with the same canted roof, so there'll be balconies and staircases. Mm-hmm. And it seems very similar. Obviously, it won't have that much parking, and so it may be that much better. And the truth is, I'm not even sure that 8 House is that bad, because I only got to visit it, you know, from the outside. I went as a tourist, but there are plenty of architecture critics who have visited it and interviewed Bjarke Ingels, and I guess I feel like nobody has assessed it from the point of view of a resident or, you know, a pedestrian, or just sort of what it's really going to work like. It feels like people are so enthralled with his ideas and his presentation and, you know, the comic book manifesto that we're not really taking it seriously.
Right. So as a critic, mm-hmm. Do you find yourself called to do any sort of analysis of the sort that you've just shared with us?
Well, I mean, yes. In a way, I self-assign it because I have a weekly blog at Design Observer, and so I write about what I want to write about. In the case of 8 House, you know, I don't have a budget to go and travel there, and so, I mean, I went there, but it wasn't completed yet, and that wasn't a professional trip. So, if I'm going to assess something and really do a critique, I have a certain standard of analysis that I want to live up to, and so I'm not going to do it in a half-assed way.
Good. As I think you should, because I believe, and because it's my show, I can pontificate as much as I want, but mostly I wanted to hear what you wanted to say, because every other week I just pontificate. Anyway, that because architecture is all-embracing, well, that's my point of view, mm-hmm. And in that I stand firmly against Eisenman's hermetic standpoint, which I think he has taken on purpose to differentiate himself from everybody else. And if Peter ever comes out, we can debate that. But because architecture involves everything in the world, air quality, light, color, quality of living, whatever you wish to define that as, post-occupancy evaluations become important, and at least in healthcare, that's become known as evidence-based design. Mm-hmm. What works, what doesn't work. As an architect, in the world that presently exists as given, and you've given in your book different examples of how criticism has been written throughout some ages, mostly 20th century writing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't get into Ruskin, which might have been interesting. For my younger colleagues who don't know Ruskin, you can find him. You need to know about Ruskin. Just so that you understand who you're talking to, part of my work is mentoring younger architects, mm-hmm. and in between being a senior technical architect at Cook Plus Fox, the people who do very large, very green buildings in New York. Mm-hmm. And so knowing about Ruskin is as important to me as knowing about Ada Louise Huxtable.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Ada Louise is still with us, she may as well be one of the ancients as far as my 20-something year old mentees are concerned, because it's inaccessible. Back to my beginning of my digression. As criticism is received by you, to what extent do you think that you can actually really negatively criticize a project, or would you be verbally or I don't know, metaphorically slapped down for saying ill of someone who was famous and therefore fabulous?
I don't think it would be slapped down. I think, you know, the more negative you're going to be, the more important it is to do a good job and, you know, have all your ducks in a row and not write anything personal. Have it all be about the work. I mean, I've written, I wrote what I thought was a fairly serious critique of 41 Cooper Square, the Tom Main building. Now, I don't know if Tom Main ever read it, but I'm not that worried about him reading it. And I also wrote a critique of Nikolai Arusov, the former New York Times architecture critic, and nothing bad happened to me after that. So I really think it's about doing it skillfully and seriously, so people know you're not doing it to try to make a name for yourself, but because you actually care and think something bad has happened to New York City.
It's almost as if you have read my cliff notes for the program, because I wanted to talk about Nikolai's writings and a feeling that I used to get, that he was viewing the world through rose-colored glasses, where everything was full of descriptors that weren't actually architectural. Jack, could we have the next break? A couple minutes of Edith Piaf.
Il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, que ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est lui pour moi, moi pour lui dans la vie. Il me l'a dit, l'a juré pour la vie. Et dès que je l'aperçois, alors je sens dans moi
was Edith Piaf with La Vie en Rose, which I really had a feeling every time I read one of Nikolai's pieces, that it was, before I started to read, I felt like, well, here goes another waste of time. I'm glad that you mentioned 41 Cooper Square, the Cooper Union New Academic Building by Tom Main of Morphosis. Back to good criticism. I'm supposing that your criticism was good and warranted and even headed. What did you have to say about it?
About 41 Cooper Square?
Yes.
I felt like it looked wonderful in photos, and I had definitely been a fan of Tom Main's work and its kind of infrastructural, you know, big qualities. But the building seemed like it had been designed for somewhere else and was totally anti-urban at the base and seemed somewhat nonsensical inside.
You're letting him off kind of easily, but okay. Fair enough.
Well, I mean, I felt the same way actually about his building in San Francisco. It's a federal building.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it's for. That when you looked at all of the, you know, the photographs, it looked sort of great from the air, but it has this totally desolate plaza in front of it with all of this security so that the nearby homeless population doesn't take it over. And so it seemed like, what was the point of that?
Yeah. a lot of us who are Cooper Union alums feel likewise with you about what you had to say about 41 Cooper Square, but we'll take it further because we happen to be architects and we happen to know people who work in the building and study in the building and you don't read any of those critiques. I don't know why.
What do you mean you don't read? I mean, you personally don't, or you feel like you haven't seen that many critiques?
I haven't seen anybody register in the newspaper of record, the New York Times, that it's a bad building.
Mm-hmm.
That students have been falling down the grand stair. For my listeners, because we have people all over the world, and we're very big in Helsinki, and they look at photographs. Some of them come to New York. It's a building that was a replacement for a previous academic and crafts building that belongs to Cooper Union at 7th Street and 3rd Avenue, and it occupies about a quarter of a New York City block. And on the outside is a crumpled-looking perforated metal screen, and that is covering over a rather ordinary glass box, could be an office building, could be anything. The ground floor is punctuated by diagonal concrete columns, which one of my colleagues has described as in total resembling a crippled lady on crutches, or a fat woman struggling to get into a dress six times too small.
Well, the sad thing about them is that they've had to put spikes on them because, of course, people wanted to skateboard on them.
And they should have been able to skateboard on them because that would be a public amenity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
And so do the skateboarders.
Yeah.
And the entrance to the building, as you look at it, would appear to be axially on the front below this giant rip in the perforated metal screen, but it's on the corner, which makes more sense for students who are coming from the old Brownstone Foundation building, but yet in terms of sighting, it's a little bewildering. And the in the inside is an atrium, and carved out of the volume of the building are steps that attempt to emulate the Spanish steps in Rome. And they go up, and they go up, and they go up again, and you really can't see where you're going as you're going up them. There's no destination. It's not like Rome, where at the top of the Spanish steps there's a church, and it's punctuated with areas where you can actually congregate and fountains and such. It's just stairs that go up and 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 up. And the idea is that students would congregate there and it would become an atrium where things could happen. And in truth, nothing ever happens there and the students don't like it. Some have fallen down and they're thinking of putting actual real handrails, not these gargantuan things that march up the sides that are look like huge earthworms rendered in black steel so that people don't fall, which makes it, from my point of view as an architect, not a successful experiment in encouraging people to walk upstairs.
Right.
But I haven't read about anybody actually looking at it 3 years after occupancy and saying, well, it's an interesting thing that might have urbanistically made some sense next to a freeway where you're driving by at 70 miles an hour and it's like, oh, look at that, that's interesting. It appears to do nothing for Cooper Square, which is a little triangular park with a statue of Peter Cooper done by Augustus St. Gaudens, one of the 19th century's top-of-the-pops sculptors. It does nothing to create pedestrian activity around the site. It just sits there, and, Tom Main got a Pritzker Prize, so therefore it must be fabulous. And Nikolai's review of it said, you know, bold and significant and public space, referring to that staring. The guards really keep you out if you wander in there and don't look.
Yeah, that's not public.
No.
I mean, it's the same thing at the, even more terrible, Kimmel Center at NYU that also has a version of the Spanish steps. You can see something at the top on those, but they're not terribly occupied, and again, they're behind barriers. I mean, there's such, it's kind of crazy now how many degrees and types of space there are between public and private, and it becomes more and more complicated to spot them because, you know, there's space behind and space that you just have to get your bag checked, space where you have to show an idea, space that's actually behind glass, space that's behind a solid wall, and, you know, there are all these layers, and it's too easy, especially if you haven't been there, to think, oh, look at those steps, you know, people can just walk in and sit down, but of course they can't, especially in New York.
And it seems to me that of the tribe of architectural critics could possibly write about that.
It's true. I mean, as I said, I did write a long critique of the building in which I pointed out a number of these things, you know, way back when. To go back and do a 3 years later or even a 1 year later assessment is something that I feel like me and my friends who are also architecture critics talk about all the time. I mean, no editor will actually pay you to do that. I think that is a major problem, but it's true that maybe I should think about doing that on my blog as an experiment, because I agree that it's it's a much better way of assessing the building than before everyone moves in when it's all bright and shiny.
Well, that gets back to what you originally said, which is that you were feeling passionate about architecture since you were 13.
Yes, I took an architecture class when I was 13. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
How cool is that?
It was cool. I built a very Richard Meyer-esque house out of paper and clay, and my mom still has a photo of it.
Wow. Where was that?
That was in North Carolina.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who knew? Who knew? How excellent. Were you near to Chapel Hill or someplace like that?
Well, actually, my mother is a graphic designer, and she teaches at the College of Design at North Carolina State University.
What town is that in?
That's in Raleigh.
Uh-huh.
It's the only architecture school in the area. And I think. And one of her colleagues had decided to teach architecture class for high school students at the local art center. So she signed me up for it, and I really loved it.
Wow, that's really great. I was in third grade, mm-hmm. and one of the unruly boys in our class brought in plans for a house that his father was building mm-hmm. for them. Mm-hmm. He hadn't designed it. But our teacher, I suppose, looking back on it, as a way to mediate this unruly guy's, Tom was his name, to mediate Tom's disruptive influence on the class, encouraged us all to look at the plans, and Tom just told us what the different symbolic elements in the plans were, that here's a straight line with a curve attached to it. That's a door. It shows how it opens. And here are the double lines that shows walls. Here's three lines that shows there's a window. And we were enraptured.
Mm-hmm.
And there began my own fascination with all of this architectural stuff. Mm-hmm. But I've lost my train of thought. So, bad architecture, bad architectural critic.
Yeah.
To my mind, just are. I know this happens. I've placed articles. I've placed ink. Back when I had my own firm. It feels like a lot of architectural critics just read the press release and write about a project in glowing terms without really thinking about it. Do you think that really happens? Maybe not in New York, but do you think it happens in other places?
Well, I guess I don't feel like there are so many people labeling themselves architecture critics. I think there are a lot of people writing about architecture, and they might do that. But, I guess I'd like to think that somebody who's calling themselves a critic and making it seem like they visited the building and toured it is not doing that. They still might not have anything interesting to say about it, or they might, just write down everything that the architect who gave them a tour says about it, which, is not very interesting or critical. But just going on the press release seems like a dereliction of duty.
I'm not going to ask you whether Nikolai did that.
I don't think that he did that. I said what I had to say about him, and I don't, want to pile on. But I think, I don't know, I feel like everyone, if you're a critic, you have to do it your own way, and I guess I just felt like his own way was very limited.
Yeah, a lot of people opined that they thought he just phoned it in from
yeah
halfway around the world.
Yeah, but he might not actually. I mean, for me, as you can probably tell, I have really strong feelings about this. And so it comes naturally to, you know, have an attitude about what I'm seeing, what I'm reading about a building, you know, to have an emotional response to it, to have it put me in some sort of mood. But I know that architecture doesn't make everyone feel that way. And you don't have to. You don't have to write about it in an emotional way, but I think if you don't love architecture and aren't just kind of excited to go see a new building, then you probably shouldn't be an architecture critic.
Well, yeah. kind of stands to reason. If your taste buds are shot, it would be hard to be a food critic unless you're just happy. Well, as you know, Heritage Radio Network, I hope you know, I'd hope you looked at our website, is mostly about food, and we are all passionate about food. And for me, there is no disconnection between good food, good air quality, good architecture, good quality of life. It's all of a piece. Back in the, you were probably building your Richard Meier model. there was a television show where it was Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And the fatuous host was always saying, "Isn't that a delicious looking meal that they've just served there on, you know, on this, you know, $26 million yacht?" We can't talk about a delicious looking meal if we've not tasted it, and you really can't write, I think, sensibly about architecture unless you have a desire to go and look at it and talk to people who use it.
Yeah.
And that, therefore, would be, I think, good criticism.
Mm-hmm.
In the next little segment, I'd like to talk about architectural journals, whether you read them, whether you endorse the point of view about archibabble or puffed up non-English perversion of the language that appears in architectural journals. That was opined upon in the Opinionator piece.
Yes. There was a pretty funny quote that Allison put in from some architectural journal.
Yeah, it was great, and we'll get to that.
Okay.
Do you read architectural journals?
I don't.
Oh, good.
I don't. I mean, I'm sort of embarrassed to say that. I guess I mostly read. Well, yeah, I read a lot of things on the internet. Other architecture blogs, other architecture articles, and I use various filters to get them. But since I finished my life in academia, I haven't really been reading that many architecture journals.
But you're still a teacher, yes?
Right, but I'm an adjunct, there's no expectation for me to publish, you know, in the Journal of the Society of Architectural Historians or in another professional journal.
Right.
Because I teach as an adjunct and I'm teaching this writing course, so actually they're happy that I wrote a book, but the fact that I, you know, published lots of articles is fine for them, you know, in the popular press.
And it doesn't matter to them because you're not part of the tenure track and all that.
Right.
Publish or perish stuff. Right.
Exactly. I decided pretty soon after I got my PhD that I was more interested in being a journalist than in being an academic.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that. Why a PhD?
Well, I really wanted to know what I was talking about. Like many young women in their 20s, I had some confidence problems. And I felt like if I got a PhD, I would be able to back up all the critical things that were already developing in my head. And so I did that, and and it worked for me. But I don't, obviously, I don't think that all architecture critics need to have PhDs. I also don't think they all need to be architects. So
no, I think
it's really whatever credential works for you, and being able to, you know, speak to architects and the interested public with some degree of authority.
Well, thank you.
I don't know. I just, yeah. People always ask me that.
Well, I'm feeling the pressure to somehow acquire a PhD because I've run into a few mountebanks who've got PhDs who think that they're architects, but they don't have licenses.
Mm.
I'm sure that your husband would have words about that. I certainly
yeah.
do.
He just took all those classes to, you know, maintain his license. So yes.
Yeah, and I, as do I. When you work in a larger firm, it's not so onerous. You just show up for lunch, and they tell you something, and you get a certificate, and it's good for an hour. And you know, there's a value for working in a larger organization. Mm-hmm. In the next segment, I would like to treat a little bit upon this disease of perversion of the language. What you think you can do with your students to rectify it? I have to say, when I read architectural journals, it makes me feel totally Martian. Jack, could we have some David Bowie, please?
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, but her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools and say, is there life on Mars?
Is there life on Mars? I'm first going to quote from this Opinionator piece.
Okay.
Here's an unidentified author who said, analysis, apparently this is some architectural thesis, a territorial and social fragmentation, a typical no man's land undergoing the urban exodus, the settlement of the old and inactive persons, the absence of public place in the body scale, substituted by the car, problematic how to attract a new living to facilitate the social and urban mixity. And then yesterday, I was walking through the village, and I came across a shop, and I saw one of these M and Co. watches, architecture you can wear. And at first glance, it's a black framed watch with a white face and Bodoni numbers, and 12 is where it belongs. And then at second look, goes 12, 4, 9, 6, 1,
right.
10,
yeah,
5.
I've seen that watch. Yeah.
Yes, and this is what the makers of the watch, in an extensive insert, came in the box, had to say. The designer, it's really tiny type, hold on while I focus. His process was born under the concept of subtraction, an ideology that follows the unification of opposites through a constant approach on the edge of architecture and visual communication, and at the same time mediated by an expressive intensity that addresses work on the basis of subtraction, fascinated by the passing of time. It's like, have we just moved to Mars? I read this stuff.
I wonder, I mean, M & Co. is, I think, you know, Tibor Kalman's company, and I almost
yes.
wonder if that wasn't meant as a joke itself.
I would hope so.
He was generally a very good writer about design.
I hope so.
Yeah.
My own aversion to this archibabble mm-hmm. probably started about 10 years ago when one of my classmates, who is now a tenured professor at Cooper Union, I overheard saying to some visitors at the annual Cooper Union student show, and they were in rapt attention, and my classmate said, my student strenuously attacked a robust program. And I stepped a few feet away, and because I studied theater when I was in college, I got a pretty good stage whisper, and I said, so professor, did they use sidearms or did they have RPGs? That won me no invitations to be a visiting critic, but I felt very strenuous in my objection to words that meant nothing. A robust program. I have no idea what that means.
Uh-huh.
There are a lot of people who write about architecture, and they just pile on a lot of words.
Uh-huh.
It reminds me of Alice in Wonderland, where Alice encounters Humpty Dumpty, and he says, well, words mean whatever I mean them to mean. And Alice says... that's very confusing. He says, well, that's because you're a confused person.
That's funny, because I've always identified with Alice in Wonderland, actually.
As well you might.
Yes. It's less for me about the words than about the strange spaces and situations in which one finds oneself, sort of on the quest to look at buildings and other things. Like that, but I don't know. I mean,
What strange quests? This sounds really juicy. Go ahead.
Oh no, it's not juicy. It's just, you know, if you love architecture, you structure all your and you're married to an architect. you structure all your vacations around seeing buildings, but
of
they're
course.
Often not buildings that the people in the community that they're a part of think of as anything special, or are expecting, you know, people from out of the country who might not speak their language to come and visit. And so you just end up having these very strange conversations where you're trying to, you know, describe a building in another language to see if someone can direct you on the street. Or, I mean, there's just this funny amount of communication required to get to locations that aren't on the tourist map. And, you know, all the best buildings seem to be off the tourist map. I mean, even when I went to see, you know, 8 House by Bjarke Ingels, we had to go, you know, way out on this subway line, and it was clearly not a space that most visitors to Copenhagen were trying to go to. But, you know, it was high on our list. Yeah.
I suppose that you ran into Danes who spoke pretty good English.
Oh, yeah. It was not an issue in Denmark. I was actually flashing on when my mother and I were in Dessau trying to find some lesser-known Bauhaus buildings.
Wow.
And her with her high school German and me with my German for reading. And anyway, it was quite an adventure.
How was Dessau?
It was really interesting. It was really interesting. And we ended up, I mean, we were looking for this famous sort of hemicycle building that by Gropius that was an employment office. And it turned out to be now sort of partially overgrown and only partially in use, and somewhat forgotten, while obviously the original Bauhaus building was in excellent shape. And this is quite a few years ago. The situation might be different now. And then we took a bus to Torten, which is this, you know, Bauhaus master designed social housing. And that was kind of fascinating because all the houses had originally been these modernist boxes, but now, you know, over the decades, people had added on to them. You know, like in Levittown,
yeah.
People have made their salt box into a colonial, into a ranch, and all of these things. Well, people in Torten, I believe that's what it's called, had done the same thing, but to these modernist houses. And that was just great to see. I mean, again, why you have to go there? Because it's not this white box paradise.
Sure.
It's developed into something much quirkier and more interesting.
Yeah. Well, now that you mention it, it was the stated intention of Peter and Alison Smithson that their brutalist housing projects post-World War II would be a framework for intervention,
mm-hmm.
and that exact sort of phenomenon would develop.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it really didn't develop quite that well, and just speaking with one of my lads, one of my mentees about this, that the 1980s techno sound, bands like Human League came out of post-war brutalist housing projects in Manchester, and their echoing sound comes from their experience of playing in clubs that were carved out of many abandoned apartments that they just took over and had raves and played their music, which just gets back to how architecture informs and is integral to everything in life.
Mm-hmm.
I want to work towards a finish with just applauding you for your aphorism here on page 66 of Writing About Architecture, Mastering the Language of Buildings and Cities from the Princeton Architectural Press. Page 66, where you say, architecture is not hermetic. I think that is really key. We can't think about architecture unless we think about it in the context of everything else that we do.
Mm-hmm.
It's our impact on the built landscape. Food trends can come and go, but buildings last a long time. Are there any last, you know, juicy thoughts that you have lingering that you'd like to share with our listeners or with me?
Juicy thoughts. Well, it's just funny to me that you brought up food. Because I've done a little writing about food and design, in particular about packaging and the kind of class messages of packaging of food design.
Excellent.
And I'm really excited to be about to review a new refrigerator for a design publication, because I feel like, you know, there's so much emphasis in the tech world on, you know, phones and computers. But we're kind of appifying so many other things. You know, there's a new thermostat. You know, this refrigerator happens to have an LCD screen. And I'm really interested in how those technologies get integrated into the home and into these appliances that maybe are more of a focus for women than for men.
There are a lot of us who, or men, who happen to cook.
That's true. But I feel like the marketing, at least that I've seen for this Samsung refrigerator, has been entirely aimed at women. But I'm glad to hear that you love to cook.
I do. I cooked for a living during architecture school, actually. Yeah. Actually, just last night I was watching The Matrix for the sixth time. And yet again, loving. The cooktop oven that the Oracle had in her apartment when Neo went to visit her, and how the oven was lifted up from below the cooktop to be at counter height.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have to bend over to take, mm-hmm. you know, she didn't have to bend over to take the cookies. out of the oven, you know, and there they were. And there's a, have a cookie. It'll all be better as soon as you eat it. It's a very architectural movie, The Matrix.
It is. It is indeed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I would hope that going forward that you're clear and sensible, meaning able to sense, and clear, meaning able to make things, able to be understood, as opposed to this bullshit crap that my supposed betters, the people who are self-identified academics, who feel that those of us who practice somehow had our brains put to sleep once we got our licenses and started to actually make buildings and somehow magically ceased to read or to think. And there is that. I'm sure that your husband, the architect, feels similarly. We care. We still continue to learn. Anyway, we hope that going forward that architectural criticism is not just tainted love for an object instead of raising and extending the level of discourse about our built environment. I'm so glad that you could join us. I hope that you might come back. You could even bring your child and your husband and your friends. We enjoy lots of chaos here in the studio. I sense that you have a lot more to say.
Sure. Yes, probably. No, I'd love to come back, and thanks so much for having me.
I'm so glad that you joined us. I think it's time to go out.
Okay.
Burning Down the House with Alexandra Lang. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, talking about criticism. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Sometimes I feel I've got to run away. I've got to get away from the pain you drive into the heart of me. The love we share seems to go nowhere. And I've lost my light, for I toss and
for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.